It's not very often that I get to sit down with a living legend, but we're here at Jazz Alley today with somebody who I have, I guess, worshipped is the right word for a long time. It's musical legend, pianist and composer Chick Corea. I first heard Chick Corea's music when he started his band Return to Forever, which I think was 1971 or 1972, if I'm not mistaken. Yeah. But Chick Corea was playing before that, and Chick Corea still plays music 40 years on down the line and changing and evolving all the time. Thank you so much for taking time to talk to me.
Yeah, sure.
Today.
Yes.
I had read that you started piano lessons at the age of 4, but when did you decide, okay, this is it, I am going to be a musician?
I don't know. I don't remember the moment because I always just kind of thought that was it, what I was doing.
Your father was a musician, right?
Yes, yes, and I always liked it, and it was what I liked to do as I grew up, so I never had another thought that I would do something else. I did a couple of different jobs, but mainly I always was focused towards wanting to play music and wanting to make music.
Was it classical, jazz, both?
I didn't really become really seriously interested in classical music until later on in high school. My first interest was the fast-moving music of bebop.
I was going to say, you came of age in the bebop era, didn't you?
My dad had a collection of 78 RPM vinyl, and a lot of the Dial label, which I'm reading about now, which had Charlie Parker on it, Dizzy Gillespie, Bud Powell, Roy Haynes, and a young Miles Davis, by the way, playing with Charlie Parker, yeah,
right,
when he
wow.
was 19, something like that. So I grew up on that music, and that's what I wanted to play. I mean, I was too young at the time to play all those fast notes, but I liked the motion of it, and that was what got me started.
I've read two conflicting things. One was that you sort of were interested in avant-garde jazz as a sort of youth, but I also read that your first job was with Cab Calloway, which I don't think of as avant-garde jazz. So were you sort of, you were eclectic even as a young guy?
Yeah, those are like two isolated moments over really a reality time stream that goes moment by moment over decades. The week I did with Cab Calloway was a filler.
Oh.
He came to town with his show, and he had dancers, and he had a little review, and he was playing the Mayfair, I think it was a hotel.
Boston?
In Boston, yes, and I was of the age where I was starting to do some jobs around, and the musicians knew I could read music and could play, and I think I was 16 at the time, and they called me to do the week there.
Wow, you must have been thrilled.
Yeah, I was pretty excited to be, you know, working at night. out at night with the musicians. I found, or my dad gave me one of his old tuxedos, which was kind of droopy around me. And actually, my biggest memory of the week is not so much on stage with Cab Calloway, but in the lounge, in between sets, I would go and sit and listen to this amazing piano player who really, really inspired me. His name was Herman Chittison. You can find him.
Yeah.
The name is not unknown. And he was kind of like an Art Tatum. He followed that kind of line of piano, solo piano playing. He was gorgeous. I had never heard anyone. So I used to sit beside him and watch him play.
When did you start writing music?
I started writing music in high school when I first started listening to Horace Silver's music. Because Horace Silver's music, after listening to the fast-moving bebop, was a little bit more accessible to me. I could copy the melodies down and copy his piano solos and so forth, and then I started trying my hand at writing tunes.
Somewhere I read that you said that compositionally you were influenced by studying classical music, but you don't write, well, you do write some things that could be called new classical music now, but earlier in your career you won't. So what was it? I mean, in your mind, was there a division about how you wrote a composition as opposed to just playing?
Yeah, you know, that division between genres of music, classical and jazz and whatever other genres, never existed in my mind, ever, ever. I never had it. So when I addressed the subject of trying to define these terms, it always is. It's a little unnatural to me. I always just heard music as music coming from different sources and different artists and in different ways. And people would say the classical music was to me a little distant because it was written down. It wasn't that real. Whereas the other music I was playing, there were real live people playing it around me, and it was real. One thing I regret, though, in growing up in the Boston area, now we're talking about classical music, is that Symphony Hall, the famous great concert hall that hosted so many incredible musicians through the early 1900s, mm-hmm. was 15 minutes from our house. And I never once attended a concert when I was growing up, unfortunately. My dad wasn't interested in orchestral music, and so, you know. I think I went into Symphony Hall for the first time when I was in my 20s with an all-star show with Dizzy Gillespie and Michael Brecker.
Well, it must have sounded great in that space, if nothing else.
Yeah.
In 68, you mentioned a young Miles Davis. In 68, you actually started playing, I think it was 68, started playing with Miles Davis.
Yes.
You were replacing Herbie Hancock, is that what it was? Or?
Yes, the band was, the great band with Herbie Hancock and Ron Carter and Wayne Shorter and Tony Williams was beginning to change. Ron had already left the band, Dave Holland was there, and Herbie was the next to leave the band, and so I came in. When I came in, Dave Holland was the bassist, but Tony was still playing the drums.
No, I was thinking about that era. That's the era I came of age. I'm just a little bit younger than you. And that was, you know, in the 50s, there was jazz, and that, you know, the Hep Cats went and saw jazz in the 50s. But, you know, there wasn't really rock and roll. But by the late 60s, early 70s, especially when you formed your first big Return to Forever as opposed to the second iteration, those two genres were sort of coming together in the mass minds. We were seeing a convergence of people coming together, and you happened to be the right age and sort of in the place when that was going on.
Yeah, I and my friends were interested in a lot of different forms and styles of music, and Miles Davis was one of the visionaries and leaders at the time, and I guess I'm surmising that he had been through so much of the earlier music coming from the bebop era and the 40s and the 50s. He was always looking for change, and I think he was always looking to stay somehow connected to the public. And so during the 2.5 years I was with the band, I saw a really pretty quick metamorphosis between a band that was wearing suits and ties to a band that was wearing bandanas and leather jackets and Miles' huge wristwatches,
right,
and all the regalia of what looked like a rock and roller.
My memory of that era is that he was as much a popular music icon as Hendrix might have been. There were pools of musicians, and nobody was thinking that guy's over there and this guy's over, and they were mostly guys at that point. Mm. You know, they're here and there, but everybody, there was a synergy, it seemed, that was happening.
There was more so. The music of jazz and improvisation was always a different form. I think the musicians that played only pop and rock and blues also looked to the jazz musicians for a certain kind of musicianship, and then the musicians who were playing jazz always looked to the pop and rock guys for, like, wow, how do they connect with audiences like that, you see?
Mm-hmm.
So that, to me, was the main synergy. That was what caused the synergies. The jazz musicians wanted to find out how to connect better, and the pop musicians wanted to find out how to play their instruments and improvise.
Improvisation is sort of a key thing I think of when I think of a group of jazz musicians playing together. You started Return to Forever. Did I get the date right? Was it 71? 72?
Around there, 71. There was a transition year where Dave Holland and I had a group called Circle for about a year and a half. And Return to Forever started late 71, I think, yeah.
And so I'm going to read some of these musicians, because Stanley Clarke, I think you still, over the years, you never lost contact with,
yes,
him. So musicians you played with, Ayrton Moreira and Flora Parim were in that original band.
Mm-hmm.
there were folks that you started with. John McLaughlin, I think, came in and out of there somewhere around then, too. Maybe not exactly right at
well,
the
John
beginning.
Well, John had formed his band, the Mahavishnu Orchestra, before Return to Forever. He was one of the first so-called fusion bands.
I hate to use that word, fusion.
That's why I said so-called.
So-called fusion.
Yeah.
But for me, what it was this chance to hear musicians who knew each other. Because back to the improvisation, you guys knew each other, you'd worked together. That, for me, was what was different when those bands came on the scene as, you know, a kid who grew up listening to the Beatles, you know, as in the 60s. You know, they knew each other, too. But what we heard on stage took off. You know, it was based on, you know, charts or whatever you guys bring up with you when you perform. And then the knowing each other and trusting each other took it to a space that we weren't used to hearing as, you know, late teenagers.
Yeah, there was a lot of camaraderie for sure, and a lot of trading of ideas and mutual inspiration at that point. There still is, actually. It's just a different methods today.
I wonder, you know, they're bandmates. Somebody used the term collaborators, but when you're on stage with a Stanley Clarke or Gary Burton, who I know you've collaborated with, are they friends? Is it a partnership? Or, I mean, how do you classify those relationships?
I don't.
You don't?
I don't, no.
Friends?
I mean, they kind of end up classifying themselves by how we work together. In my life, it always either starts with or develops quickly into a friendship. We like the same things, and we have the same goals in what we want to achieve with music. And then the relationship develops from there.
What are some of those goals?
Well, I don't know. They're the kind of goals that's hard to put into words. They seem to cheapen when you put words onto them. But one of my goals is freedom of the individual and the freedom to express yourself. I think all artists have that as a basic desire. Actually, all people do. It gets submerged in a lot of people, but that's one of the ways I like to live. I like to be able to think freely and play my music freely, but I also like to cause really positive effects on people around me, and so I'm always trying to balance out how to take the music that's my personal taste mm-hmm. in music. And then how to give as much of that as I can and get it across to an audience rather than alienate them with something that I might be interested in, but they certainly wouldn't.
So can I use the word accessibility?
Well, you can. It's a cheapened word. That's why I stay away from it. All of the words that have to do with reaching an audience have been cheapened somehow. You're made to feel that you shouldn't reach an audience, that you're selling out or something, and all of that stuff. So, but in actual fact, to me, life is pretty dull unless it's a social event. Life is a social event to me. You have families, and you have, as an artist, you have audiences and people around you, and I like to affect people positively.
One of the big influences that we hear, and I only started to read about when I knew I was going to talk with you, is a sort of rhythm, a Latin melodies come into your work. And I read that I guess I always thought that your family was Latin American, but they're from Spain originally, right? Your dad's family?
No, my mother's mother and father are from Messina, Sicily. And my father's mother and father are from Catanzaro, which is in the Reggio Calabria,
Italian.
South of Italy. They're both Italian.
Well, where did the Latin influences come from?
That's why I made a record called My Spanish Heart.
Right.
I fell in love with Latin music when I was and Spanish culture when I was young. The rhythms and the musical culture just have always... I've always felt at home with them. So I played with a dance band when I was in high school that got me into it. Phil Barbosa, he was a trumpet player. I met a conga player named Bill Fitch who got me into the New York salsa via Tito Puente mm-hmm. and Machito and Eddie Palmieri. And then I met Paco de Lucia some years later that introduced me to flamenco culture. And since then, you know, I've met musicians from South America and the islands.
Yeah, I'm thinking of your tune Spain, which is like probably the most famous of your songs from the 70s, I think. Maybe your first big hit. How is a rhythm structure, an American rhythm structure, different from a Cuban rhythm structure,
well,
or a Brazilian?
Aside from doom, 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 there is no such thing as an American rhythm.
We don't have one.
I mean, American rhythms are combinations of, if you want to get nerdy about it, they're combinations of rhythms from Europe and Africa and South America and our native Indians and Asia. And America was just a whole bunch of trees and grass for a while, right?
True.
And
totally.
Native Americans had a musical culture that was, which was part Oriental, I believe. But our musical roots and Latin musical roots come via Africa, and then combined with the music of Europe and song music, you have like so many different cultures and streams of music which produce different rhythms and different dances, and you know, it's endless.
So for you as an audience member and not a music maker, what really touches your soul when you hear it?
I get easily moved by anything creative. I get moved to tears by some fresh creation, so almost anything.
Well, that's nice for you
yeah,
as an
it's
audience
nice,
member.
It's nice for me. I mean, but as a pianist and composer and professional, like trying to always improve myself, I spend most of my listening time on projects, trying to improve myself or trying to find out something more that interests me about a certain musician or a certain way of music, and I'll get into studying them to break it down to see if I can learn something further. Is there something missing in my musical language and I want to add to it?
One of the things that's really astonishing when you start reading about your history is not only that you've been actively making music for five decades or so, but that you have what seems to be a constant and ever-changing series of projects, bands, if you want to call them that, sometimes simultaneously. And like they're, you know, I wonder if you ever sleep or do you ever stop, because it's just constant.
They appear simultaneous because I guess there's several of them in a year or something like that. But they're actually quite concentrated and specific. Like this is the tour that I'm out with my new band, The Vigil. And that's what I'm doing. I'm doing The Vigil. Although I have a couple other projects that I'm preparing for, like in the afternoon, I'm writing some music for three other projects. But when I come to perform at night, it's concentrated on the group.
Well, so what is The Vigil now? What is this latest project?
Oh, it's, I've been wanting to put a new band together to play music that has been kind of stacking up. Like small group music. And I've been doing so many collaborations these past 5-10 years.
Yes.
With Bela Fleck, with Bobby McFerrin. I have more collaborations this year with Stanley Clark, Gary Burton, as you mentioned. That the music that I write for a small group, it was something I wanted to explore more. And I had this idea of combining percussion with the percussionist, which we're now experimenting with. So I developed relationships with these and met some of these young musicians, and we put it together, we made a recording, and we're touring and performing all year.
You were born in 1941, so people can do the math. You're in your early 70s, and you have the energy of somebody 25. Do you anticipate a point where you'll just want to take it a little bit easier?
No, not really. That's a bodily function, not a spiritual one.
The spirit's strong always.
Yeah, I mean, life is to me is communication and activity and being with friends and of course for me is playing music. So that's life.